Committee members, I think I'm going to call the meeting to order. We're waiting for the chief author, but we do have some documents that might be helpful for us to look at just before the chief author gets here. Okay, I think we have a quorum. Oh, almost. Representative McNamara, you just about brought us there. I'm going to call the meeting to order, and we do have one bill on the agenda today, the mortgage registry tax and deed tax bill, and that'll be coming before us shortly. The chief author is held up in another committee, so we have some information that we could go through just briefly, and I think maybe Mr. Halbeck, would you like to take us through that? And then I'm going to make sure, Mr. Kramer, that you're the first witness. As soon as we have the presentation, is that okay? I understand you have to leave. Okay. Can you hang with us for a few minutes? Okay. So until we have our chief author to present the actual bill, welcome to the committee, Mr. Halbeck.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Chip Halbeck with Minnesota Housing Partnership. And as a warm-up act, I will provide a little bit of background on the out-of-reach report. In conjunction with the bill you're about to hear, we felt it would be of interest to the committee to receive some information on the rent levels that in the linkage between rents and incomes that's just being released today by the National Low Income Housing Coalition and in Minnesota by our organization, Minnesota Housing Partnership, and the Consortium of Community Developers. And what this report is done on an annual basis. Well, welcome. Should I wrap it up? Or
well, maybe just continue and complete it, but welcome, Representative Marker. We haven't put your bill on the table yet. We're just hearing a little report, related report from Mr. Halbeck.
But I could just say that, again, that what is being tracked is the fair market rent, and it's for the state as a whole, each of Minnesota's metro areas, and then every county in Minnesota for 2010, and that's compared to different income levels for the same year in terms of what's the mean income for a renter household, what's minimum wage, what that household at minimum wage could afford, and on. And so that information is provided to you to show the rent burden that Minnesotans at these different income levels face in individual counties as well as for the state as a whole. And what that shows is that not in every county in the state, but at least in the majority of the counties of the state, that people who are the average income renter cannot afford the average two-bedroom apartment. And if you are at minimum wage, you cannot afford an efficiency apartment anywhere in the state except, I believe, in one county. So it's we believe that this information is just of value for Minnesotans and the Housing Committee to understand how, on an annual basis, the rent levels that are found across the state, what they mean in compared to what renters actually earn. And with that, I could take any questions, or we could move on to the bill. So thank you for allowing me
to
testify.
I think what we'll do is hold the possible questions for people to ask you after. Representative Marquardt, I want to welcome you to the committee, and I know that you are in your own committee with several bills up. But I want to say I'm so appreciative of your leadership in this bill. It's been a long time coming, and I want to invite you to present your bill. We'll move House File 3725, be recommended to pass, and I believe referred to the Committee on Taxes. Is that correct? No? Return to Finance, excuse me, but perhaps on its way eventually. So welcome to the committee if you'd like to present your bill and any of your
Thank
witnesses.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and I must say it's an honor to carry this bill, and I truly mean that. I mean, usually I think of myself as a property tax guy type of bills and not one that would carry an affordable housing bill. But I have to say, as I was a mayor of a city, that it was very important. But as I looked at the efforts that are being performed of all the housing advocates and your leadership and Representative McFarland's on some of the bills she's worked on, this has such a huge impact that it's an honor that I'm able to carry this bill, because there's not a lot of times where you can carry a bill that can have such a huge impact socially and economically as I believe House File 3725 does. Not only does it address the affordable housing situation, but it also deals with economic issues, putting people to work, mm-hmm. and creating more stable families, and increasing student achievement. It's all, housing is related to all of those things. And then I can start talking about rural economic development, but, and I will later here in just a second. But so it's an honor to carry this bill, because I think it's going to have a huge impact on the state of Minnesota. And what's nice about this bill also is that it has some standards that we're setting. What we're saying with House File 3725, and I'll get to the mechanics of it in just a short time, is that we're going to try to reach a standard of 1,000 housing units, owner-occupied or rental, 1,000 units a year for the next 10 years. And we think we can probably do 1,500 a year, so 10 to 15,000 new affordable housing units. Our shortage around the state is about 33,000. So we can do about a third of that. But the current level right now with the challenge funds of about $9 million a year, we're doing 300 to 400 new housing units a year. That means it's going to take 100 years to hit that 33,000. We think with this effort and this approach that we can really ramp that up and increase and get to that goal of 33,000 ultimately. Another thing that we think will occur with this is it will create about 15,000 new construction jobs, direct jobs, in the next 10 years. And that's vital. The construction trades were one of the biggest areas hit with the recession that we see right now. Just a little bit of the research, and I know many of you are already aware of this, but as I looked into this, it really struck me. The Wilder Foundation did a research in 2008 in the seven-county metro area, and when you talk about those who are cost-burdened, paying 30% or more of their income into housing, found out that about 33% of those folks in the seven-county metro area are paying 30% or more. That's an uptick from 25% back in 2000. Another study showing that 1 in 8 people are paying 50% or more in their housing of their income. 1 out of 8 in the state. And that's a huge increase over just 10 years ago. 75% of all low-income people are cost-burdened. And that goes across whether or not you're in rural Minnesota or metro Minnesota. One of the things that struck me as a teacher is in that Wilder Foundation report that there was some University of Minnesota professors that did research on the stability of a family or stability of housing to education levels, and they found very close ties to housing stability, family stability, to educational achievement. And, you know, think of the cost there, that if you can provide affordable housing for folks, and you can create more stable families, what you can do with education and down the line economically and as far as achievement levels. In rural Minnesota, it's a huge factor. There was a study done not so long ago that said, you know, why are a lot of rural areas losing population? And it's because of a shortage of jobs and housing. And in rural Minnesota, what we've seen is that a lot of the young people are out migrating to the cities or wherever. And so when employers try to find employees, they have to go further distances. And so what happens is a lot of the people working in rural Minnesota have to travel a lot of miles to get to their place of work because there's not affordable housing where the work is at. And in many cases, it's both spouses going different directions that may have to travel quite a bit. And so when you look at affordable housing in rural Minnesota, it is a huge factor in the growth of the business, but also in the stability of the workforce. And examples, you've got DigiKey in Thief River Falls, or Marvin Windows in War Road, or Swift and Company in Worthington. These are areas that employ a lot of folks, but they don't have the housing available, and that is a huge, huge economic rural issue. The city of Detroit Lakes, the former mayor there, Larry Buchholz, sent me a letter on this and says that 1 in 4 households in Becker and Clay County are paying at least 30% of their income in housing. And almost 1 in 3 renters in Becker and Clay County are paying at least half of their income in housing. That's forcing people to make other choices, which they should not. You know, you have the necessities of food and clothing and shelter. And when you've got to spend 50% on one of those, other things are going to have to go. The city of Moorhead, Mayor Voxland, talking about the Challenge Fund program, says that, and he actually listed 3 different developments in their city where they've used Challenge Fund grants and have been able to leverage those grants with community block grant dollars and other types of funding. But one point he makes that a lot wouldn't think about, Moorhead, of course, along the North Dakota border, is they said without those challenge funds that a lot of folks now living in Moorhead would be living in Fargo. So there you hurt your tax base, it makes a huge input. So, the more I looked into this issue, the more, I guess, passionate I actually became as a tax guy to look into this issue. And so what do we do with this bill? How do we pay for it? What we do is we look at capturing from 2011 on, we look at capturing any of the increase in the mortgage and deed tax from year 2011 for the next 10 years. And according to revenue estimates, in the first year it would capture about $19 million in new funding, and then after that about $39 million a year. Now, I could go over the mortgage and deed tax and what that is, and if you've got questions, but other than that, it's the mortgage and deed tax has gone up and down. Of course, when housing, the mortgage tax is paid on the amount of your mortgage, and it's a percentage. And the deed tax is actually a transfer tax, and that's paid on the value of the home sale. So, of course, more home sales, more mortgages, more refinancing, which occurred in the 90s and parts of the 2000s, this decade, that went way up, and now it's come down, and they're looking at it going back up again. So there is no increase in the mortgage and deed tax. It is just capturing those new dollars that would otherwise go to the general fund. Now, that's the big question is why are we going to take away $40 million from the general fund? And I would argue that any budget is setting priorities. And when you can leverage dollars, and this challenge fund leverages about $1 to $6, but not only in dollars point of view, but when you can create jobs, you can create more stable families, you can create educational levels, you can provide workforce development in rural Minnesota, that $1 does a lot of work. And that $1 also comes back by increasing the property tax base in these communities, which lowers property taxes than they would otherwise be in communities, which strengthens the existing housing stock, helps the existing economic development in those areas. And so I would argue that, you know, we can come up with a lot of priorities, but I think this is a big one. And so I have no problem sitting before you and saying that $40 million should go to affordable housing. This bill, that's how it works. It's 10 years. It's a sunset. In the bill, it says we will report back. They will report back once a year, back to the chair here, back to the Senate, and talk about how they're making progress on those 1,000 units per year. We're looking at 15,000 new jobs that would be created from this bill. So, members, I can answer more details, I guess, but again, I've carried a lot of bills, but this bill really tends to get into all sorts of areas when we're talking about quality of life in this state. And so, with that, Madam Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Representative Margaret, for that passionate presentation. I really share your feelings about this, and I'm excited to Representative Severson, did you have a question?
I have a couple questions, Madam Chair. Representative Marquardt, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. I know that we dealt with this bill a little bit a couple years ago, and it was an increase, which I understand this is not. This is at the current level that's being assessed on our homeowners that are buying homes. And I also appreciate the fact that these come from homes, so it's probably an appropriate arena in which to reinvest. I think the first line of questioning would be, number one, so if we're targeting individuals for the challenge fund, what income level are we targeting for the benefits that would be received from this provision?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Severson. First of all, in state law, Chapter 462, I got to find my statute here.
833.
And my glasses. But Statute 462A.33 talks about the qualifications, and what it says is for home or owner-occupied homes, it has to, the income level has to be 115% or lower than the median family income in Minnesota. And so that total would be, I think, about 90 to 90 some thousand dollars, roughly that. But on the average, what tends to, as was seen earlier, the average person receiving a challenge fund grant in households is about 33,500 income. And for rental, it's 80% of that median, and that is about, I'm getting a couple numbers, that's about 65,000 or less they would need to qualify. But the average person getting a benefit of a challenge fund medium household would be about 24,000. So that's roughly the income level of those folks that would be receiving the benefits of this program.
Madam Chair. Yeah, thank you. And I can see at the 24,000 to 36,000 level. I have a little bit more of a difficult time seeing it as the 91,000 or in that arena. I guess I would, the first question I ask you, Representative Marquardt, is how much do you make a year? You probably qualify for that. You know, that's kind of where we're both at here. And so my question is, I mean, part of the process is here we're kind of hedging one against the other. The other is the taxpayer is paying through this that funds that normally go into the general fund that offset some of the taxes they would be required, whether it's in property tax or sales tax or some of the other service taxes that we currently assess. Because if we don't have that $40 million in the general fund, now we have to accrue those funds from someplace else. So I'm wondering, in the terms of the program here, if we're going to, you know, kind of maneuver within this program, if it wouldn't be to our benefit to try and ramp it down to be more targeted towards the lower income and thus requiring fewer funds getting out of that, you know, the 33,000 home deficit earlier. I don't know if you get where I'm going with this thing, but I think in terms of making it so broad to the larger income getters, we offset the accomplishment of the goal that we're going after, which is helping the low income, by broadening out the benefit package, if you will. Yeah. And so I'm wondering if you had considered any of those options in this process.
Madam Chair and Representative Severson, I mean, you bring up excellent points there. No, this bill didn't go into any further in dealing with the requirements of Chapter 462A and dealing with the 115 or the 80%. I think in reality what's happening is the, you know, it's 24,000 for rental units and about a 33.5 income for owner-occupied. So the reality of it is that's where, I don't know for sure specifically how those dollars get there or how that exactly works. I know we have people in the room that could answer that. But getting back to another part of your question on, like, the $40 million is there's a lot of return here. I mean, the if there's new housing stock, of course, that brings in more property taxes. There's the sales tax, and just the fact that people now can be more employed in this area would raise some income tax revenues. I mean, there's a payback, certainly. And I think in times of budget deficits, we really need to concentrate programs. I agree with that philosophy, but I guess it's beyond me to know how I would do that with this. And I wanted to keep this simple, and I think the advocates wanted to keep this as simple as possible and not delve into the other areas of the law.
Just follow up.
I think we could hear from some of the folks who might be able to go into some of the detailed answers that you're interested in.
Yeah, okay. Madam Chair, there are several witnesses, yep. too. I forgot to mention.
You want to wait? Or?
Well, and just to this line, and perhaps there's some others that can come down and address this issue specifically, but I think one of the questions that should this bill move to the floor and we debate it as a body, one of the questions that would arise is what has been the trends in the past, the amount of affordable housing we have had in the past through our pretty aggressive program that the governor has had in the last few years in terms of trying to end long-term homelessness. What kind of gains have we made? Have we reduced the percentage of homeless, or are we seeing kind of a continually moving target in the future that, in essence, begs the question, if there's 33,000 now today and we're doing it at 1,000 a year for the next 10 years, we bite off a third, why wouldn't it be 40,000 by the time this program is over? And so I guess those are some questions that I think we're better off addressing now than when we get 10 years down the road having done this program and not really resolved the issue. That's all I have, Madam Chair.
Sure, Representative Stevenson. And I think some of the folks who are coming up can maybe respond to some of those points too. So let's go right now to Steve Kramer, Project for Pride and Living. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Kramer.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Steve Kramer. I'm the executive director at a nonprofit community development corporation called Project for Pride and Living. We work throughout the Twin Cities. Our mission focus is to help low-income families and individuals become more self-sufficient by addressing housing and employment and family stability and educational needs. And I'm proud to be here to support House File 3725. I thought Representative Markwart did an excellent job explaining the legislation and the need for it. I would just emphasize a couple of points. I do think that the bill is crafted in a way that's responsive to the challenging times that we all face, especially those of you in the legislature in these hard economic moment for our state. It leaves the current base of deed and mortgage tax revenues in place for the state's ongoing spending needs, addresses the huge need for affordable housing investment, which I'll talk about more in a moment, starting in 2012 with the growth of these dollars as the general housing market begins to recover, which we certainly hope that it will in the near future. And it focuses the additional investment that would be possible in affordable housing by virtue of the bill through a highly effective Minnesota housing program with a track record of success and a demonstrated history, as the representative said, of leveraging other resources. That's the challenge program. So without a doubt, those of us here to testify in favor of the bill are saying that there is a need for additional investment in affordable housing, but I think House File 3725 offers a practical and responsible way to address that need among the many needs that you all are dealing with at the legislature in this session and for the foreseeable future. So let me just focus on the affordable housing need question for a moment, and make no mistake, the need is great. PPL provides about 1,000 rental units throughout the Twin Cities. The families we work with around the poverty level, not 115% of income, not 80% of income, around the poverty level, are really priced out of the market if we can't help them. So it doesn't do them any good if there are vacant units if they can't afford the rent. It doesn't do any good that there are homes available for sale if the families that we can't help through our rental or our ownership program don't have sufficient income to qualify for a mortgage that would allow them to buy that home. And more people are in that position because of the effect of the economy, because of job loss, or even more importantly, for many people we work with, simply having hours cut back so that their incomes are reduced, affecting their ability to afford rent, affecting their ability to afford a home. And as the representative suggested, we see through the rest of our work, we see the impact of housing instability very clearly in terms of educational achievement for kids and families we're working with that maybe have to move two or three times from a shelter to an apartment, back to a shelter, to a relative's couch in the spare room. We see it in terms of the impact of people trying to reconnect with the employment market, not having a regular address, not having a computer access to apply for a job, and we're seeing the effect of all of that in increasing mental stress, mental health issues throughout all of the people that we work with. So without a doubt, dedicating more resources to address the affordable housing crisis is an important reason to support this legislation. By doing so, you also address other important goals. Investing in affordable housing results in jobs, and it results in additional tax revenues. If I just use my organization, PPL, as an example, projects that we completed in 2008 or 2009, or that we're working on this year, or know we'll work on next year in 2011, have or will result in 272 units of new or renovated affordable rental or affordable ownership housing. While working on those 272 units, we're going to construct, just those units alone are going to create 311 construction jobs and generate $8.7 million in taxes at all levels of government, local, state, and federal. But if we just look at the state level, we know from the research that Chip Halbach's organization has done, Minnesota Housing Partnership, that Minnesota recoups half of its investment in affordable housing just in the first year through increased sales, mortgage, deed, and income tax revenues. And then some of those revenues continue to flow into state coffers. And, of course, at the local level, there are additional property tax revenues that greatly help your local partners deliver the important services that they are responsible for. So by meeting the compelling affordable housing need, you also, through this bill, address important economic development priorities like job creation and generating additional governmental revenue at all levels. Finally, Madam Chair, members, let me just say a word about the Challenge Fund. Again, using my organization as an example, we have found the Challenge Fund to be a very effective and very flexible program to address a wide variety of housing needs, everything from helping to address the foreclosure crisis in parts of the Twin Cities where federal funding is not available for that reason, to creating affordable ownership opportunities in suburban communities. And if I could address the targeting question just for a moment, it is true that the upper limits for ownership projects and rental projects are, as Representative Marquardt stated, but as a practical matter, using our experience and I think the experience of other developers, particularly nonprofit community developers, we're really looking at reaching people well within those targets. The rental projects that we do using Challenge Fund dollars are serving people literally coming out of shelters into stable housing maybe for the first time, up to a maximum of 50% of the median income, closer to the high 30s to low 40s for a family of four. And in the case of ownership projects, we're working with people who are first-time buyers at 60 or 70 or 80% of income, really the income just above where my friend Sue Hagan, the Habitat for Humanity program, can reach because of their unique model, people who just barely can qualify for a mortgage. So the upper limits are what they are, but the real practical targeting is much more directed towards the low end of that range. And on the leverage side, I know the aggregate leverage for the Challenge Fund is 6-to-1, as Representative Marquardt stated. In our experience, again, doing highly affordable projects, it's closer to $9 or $10 of other investment for every dollar of state Challenge Fund that goes into our projects. And that's private equity coming in through the low-income housing tax credit program from investors all over the country. It's private financing from banks and home buyers. It's federal dollars flowing through local jurisdictions like Minneapolis or St. Paul or suburban communities where we work. So the Challenge Fund is a great vehicle for the use of these dollars that House File 3725 would generate. And with that, Madam Chair, I'd be happy to either answer questions now or later after you have other testimony.
Any comments, questions from committee members? Okay, thank you. That was very thorough. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, Susan Hay, Habitat for Humanity. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Sue Haig, and I'm the president of Twin Cities Habitat for Humanity, and I'm very pleased to be here. Thank you, Representative Markert, for authoring this bill and for hearing this bill this session. This is an extraordinarily important affordable housing bill for us as a community, certainly for us as an organization, Habitat for Humanity. Our goal is to eliminate poverty housing and make decent, affordable shelter for all people a matter of conscience. Our organization works throughout the 7 metro county area as a Habitat organization, but there are Habitat affiliates in every corner of this state. There are 25 Habitat affiliates, and so I think I'm really speaking for all the Habitat affiliates throughout Minnesota that this is so needed to help us do our work. The housing crisis for us has really meant that we have changed how we do our work right now. So we are out acquiring homes that have gone into foreclosure and rehabbing those homes and helping neighborhoods to create some stability and bring back stable low-income homeownership. Habitat homeowners are very low income. They are earn between 30 to 50% of area median income. We apply for challenge funds to help us acquire land and infrastructure development costs for housing. Typically, as Steve Kramer has said from PPL, these are very, very competitive funds, so generally about 4 or 5 times as many projects as there are resources available, and they always go to those organizations that are really serving the lowest income people and getting the best return on other investment. When we get public resources from this source to help us at Habitat, it's only a small portion of the total cost. The rest of the investment comes from the homeowner mortgage payments. Habitat finances the sale of these homes to our partner homeowners. They pay 0% 30-year mortgage to us, so that helps finance it. We get individual contributions from corporations and congregations, and then just individuals. So the public investment really stimulates a lot of other private investment in housing, and it is so important for stability. I thought Representative Markert said it so well. At Habitat, we always say that healthy families start at home, and success at school starts at home, and safe and stable neighborhoods start with safe and stable housing. And this legislation is really going to help us be able to achieve some of these goals. We turn away 10 qualified homeowners each year for the one homeowner that we can serve. We have now built 780 Habitat homes in the Twin Cities. We've built in 47 cities in the 7 metro county area. And if I had 10 times the public resource, I would go out and raise 10 times of the private resource to help us begin to meet this need. So this is a particularly vital source for us. It really gives me some hope that there's some future for us as I think about this legislation. We are working today on acquiring land and properties that we will be developing 2 years from now. So any investment now is going to help us 2 years from now, 3 or 4 or 5 years from now. And when we're making investment in affordable housing at Habitat, it isn't just for 1 year or one program year. This is a 30-year investment for these families. They're going to have permanent stability for their lifetime in these houses. So it's a really good public investment. It's a small public investment in comparison to the private investment, and extremely important. The ability to build 1,000 additional units per year in the state would be truly extraordinary if you think about where we are. The Challenge Fund is only able to fund about 400 units a year right now, and we just aren't able to keep pace. So thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer questions about Habitat for Humanity and the income of the families that we serve or our program.
Thank you. Any questions from Ms. Haig, committee members?
Just one.
Representative Severson.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. And I just wanted to find out, in terms of Habitat for Humanity, are those all new structures, or are you doing rehab on some foreclosed homes?
We are doing a lot of rehab right now. So in partnership with several of the public entities, the cities, the counties, we are using some neighborhood stabilization program money that is flowing temporarily into the public agencies to help acquire homes that have gone into foreclosure. and then we're rehabbing those homes. If the homes are rehabable, not all of them are. Some of them are so dilapidated, they really need to be torn down. We're trying to make that judgment about what is the right level of public investment. It's probably going to be well over 50% of our work in this next year. And it is very important. To me, it's the ultimate sustainability. If you can preserve a house, make it energy efficient, and have it be a good, safe place for a family, it's a very good thing to do. Not all of the properties you can do that with.
And just one thing. Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up on that issue, if you have obviously have a waiting list for people for affordable housing here, is there ever a program that allows them to be putting in sweat equity along with the workers that are in that process?
Yeah. Thank you for asking. I should have said that at the beginning. all Habitat owners contribute 300 to 500 hours of sweat equity to build their home. So they're working right alongside the volunteers. I see at the table there are several legislators who have helped us as volunteers at Habitat, so thank you for that. But the homeowners are learning to be successful homeowners by providing sweat equity, but we also have a rigorous education program for all of our homeowners. They attend a 10-class curriculum before we close on the sale of the home to make sure they understand their rights and responsibilities as homeowners and that they will be successful for the long run.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good program.
Thank you, Representative Severson.
Thank you very much.
I'm impressed. You said about half of the, if I understood you, about 50% of the projects are foreclosures. You're dealing with foreclosures. I'd be interested, too. I don't know. I didn't ask this of the previous witness, but I'm wondering if that's, you know, maybe the next person who's coming up can talk about that, too. That's a really significant percentage considering, you know, the lack of resources in it.
Right.
So I appreciate knowing that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We were doing new construction before the foreclosure crisis hit, and so once the foreclosure crisis changed the housing market, we had to change our model to take the same volunteer model and go in and do the rehab work. And we'll do that as long as we have the public resources to help us. There's a big front-end cost to acquire those properties, and the public investment is really critical to helping us be successful there.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Next, I have Jeff Huggett. Did I say that right? Or Huggett?
Okay.
Huggett. Welcome to the committee from Dominion Development. And, please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for hearing my testimony. My name is Jeff Huggett. I'm a partner with Dominion Development and Acquisitions. We're headquartered in Plymouth. We own or manage about 19,000 apartment units in 20 states, including about 8,000 units in Minnesota. We've been in business for 38 years, and approximately two-thirds of the units that we own or manage are considered affordable rental housing units. Over the past decade in Minnesota, we've either preserved or created about 1,500 units of affordable housing in Minnesota. And these housing units were supported by state and local funding sources. Without that support, the projects that we've been involved with just wouldn't have been able to move forward. And very similar to the other witnesses and what Chip was saying, you know, these properties, they received about $20 million in state and local aid, and created over 1,000 construction jobs and additional permanent jobs to operate the properties, et cetera. About 1,000 jobs. You know, it seems like it's pretty consistent with what the other witnesses were saying and what the studies have said. In particular, two of the properties that we worked on over this past decade. We're recipients of challenge funds, and I actually brought a few pictures of those. If that would be okay, I'd be more than happy to share with
you. Sure, we can have the circulate the photos. Thank you.
I'll just that.
You can take them and.
Oh, thank you. These two particular properties, the larger of the two is called Stone Creek at Medicine Lake Apartments. Located in Plymouth, Minnesota. That was 132 apartment units. It was completed in 2004. It was a new construction property. Some of the units were affordable and some were market rate. The second property is called Blooming Glen Apartments. It's located in Bloomington. That was an acquisition and substantial rehabilitation of 50 HUD subsidized units in Bloomington, substantially improving that property. Both of these properties primarily serve, in the affordable units, single mothers with young children. Many of the of our residents in these two particular properties work at low wage retail jobs, nursing assistants, some education, administrative type positions. Typically, we're seeing that families are moving to these two locations mainly for the good schools, so that their children will be able to have a better life than they are necessarily. In these two particular properties, we received approximately $1.2 million in challenge funds, and that created 180 construction jobs, and it would have created 84 affordable housing units. As a developer of affordable housing, it takes us typically about 1 to 3 years to plan an affordable housing property. And for our planning purposes, it's just critical to have programs like Challenge in place, where we know that it's going to be there year in and year out. From our perspective, affordable housing is a long-term asset that requires a long-term commitment. And I would say to you that if you make the long-term commitment to funding affordable housing, development groups throughout the state, such as the folks that have already testified today, will respond by planning and providing for the affordable housing needs, in all of our communities. And like you've also already heard, this has the added benefit of putting plenty of Minnesotans back to work. So I thank you for sponsoring this bill, and thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Huggett. I have questions from committee members, comments? I just want to say these are very beautiful photos, and it was interesting to hear the type of work that most of the people who are living in these units do, the low income retail, and it must provide a lot of hope for them.
Yeah.
Well, plus the construction jobs that are higher wage.
It's important to us that that a property be beautiful like that, because we want people to live in a nice environment and believe that that's part of improving communities and neighborhoods. And what we found, these are just two particular properties, but we're all serving just a wide variety of Minnesotans that just happen not to have a lot of resources, and it takes a lot of us doing it, in a lot of different parts of the state to make our state work. So again, thank you for your support.
Thank you. Okay, well, anybody else in the audience who wishes to testify for or against the bill? If not, Ms. Lee wants to testify?
Yes.
Representative Benson, did you have a question?
I just had a question. I think we may have missed one of the testifiers, possibly last one, said what the wait time was for these affordable housing units.
We missed one of the testifiers?
Well, I don't remember.
Are you talking about the realtors?
Yeah.
No, they decided apparently not to testify today, but they could be answering any questions if there were. Did you have a question for them?
Well, I just wondered we were discussing whether or not there had been statistics on the wait time for these affordable housing units.
Why don't we get to that after Ms. Lee's testimony?
And fine.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers, and also on behalf of the Asian Pacific American Housing Consortium, or APAC. I'm also speaking related to the communities of color that are affected, being that many of them fall in the population as far as needing these affordable homes. I wanted to just raise the issue regarding the communities, those who have been faced by foreclosure and not finding ways to come up with successful loan modifications. Are some of these people that they were talking about being in the shelters or living with their relatives on those couches and so forth? And so the question then would be of how these people who have already faced foreclosure be able to become these homeowners now that they're in this other category and therefore facing the needs for affordable homes like they were talking about as being made available here, being that they have this black mark as far as the foreclosure issue. Now, these also affect the moderate income people, too, who have been faced by foreclosure. They are now then in a category of these low income. And they have, through no fault of their own, whether it's job loss, job cuts, or medical expenses, have become put in this category. The other thing is we would like to be able to work with the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency on the rehabilitation of some of these homes and the use of funds in making it affordable to these communities of color. I'm not just speaking for the Asian Pacific American populations, but we do network with the other communities of color, and we do know their interests as far as being involved in these issues. And from the standpoint of the jobs created, some of you know about Hire Minnesota that is also working to be able to have people of the different ethnic communities. And when Representative Severson was talking about sweat equity, that they become involved also in some of these work as far as the rehabbing of the homes that they live in or else some of the jobs that are available through this process. But we do think this is an excellent opportunity, and we, as I mentioned, we just wanted to make the position known. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Does anyone want to respond to Representative Benson's question from either the author of the bill or any of the testifiers previously? I think it was a question about, you want to repeat your question, Representative Benson?
Yeah. We were just wondering what the wait time is now for affordable housing for people who are applying.
Okay.
We have lots of people. As we know, we have a great backlog, and so we're just curious as to how long it takes for people to be able to move into one of these units.
Okay, it looks like Ms. Haig has come back. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, at Habitat, the wait could be as long as 2 or 3 years. And actually, what we ask homeowner applicants to do is we ask them to reapply every year. Because we are a fair credit lender, we have to go in and verify their income and their working situation and their eligibility, so we have to recertify them. The process is different for different rental programs, and I really can't answer the question about the rental program, so I have to have somebody else do that.
Thank you. Mr. Halbach, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, again, Chip Halbach, and just to point on the rental program, and the longest wait list are for the Section 8 rent subsidy programs, and that each jurisdiction has its own policies for how long it and how frequently it opens its waiting list. But I can just say across the state, those waiting lists are extremely long. As an example, in Minneapolis, they last year opened the waiting list for 3 days, I believe. And their projection is that for someone who got on that waiting list, I think it was July of last year, it could be as long as 10 years before their name would come up. And they opened the list very infrequently, 5 to 10 years. So altogether, it could be as long as 20 years at the extreme. But it's certainly no less than 4 or 5 years.
Thank you.
Thank you. That really speaks to the need, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Representative McFarland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Representative Marquardt.
Thank you.
Line 1.13, it talks about the dedicated money may be used to pay for debt service on bonds. The may makes me wonder, are we able to pay for things like permit fees, closing costs, and things like that that would incur less debt for these people? I mean, the may makes me wonder, is it about the debt service?
I don't know if someone else can answer that specifically. I don't you're talking about the debt service and what it could be spent on? Is that
No, it says it may be used to pay for debt service. Can it pay for other things other than debt service?
I
see. Do we have someone? Representative Mr. Hallbeck, do you want to come down?
Well, yeah, I think someone
looks
else.
Like you might have a response to that.
The Challenge Fund has a broad range of applicability, and the agency typically uses it, the Minnesota Housing, the agency typically uses that fund to fill in after other funding sources have been identified, and then it uses the Challenge Fund to come in and pay the remaining costs that are needed to bring down a project to an affordable level. So it's from fees to construction cost and the like. And on the home ownership side, my understanding is that the flow from the agency is to a nonprofit or other developer that creates the housing, and the developer prepares and has provided to the agency a budget for, again, what the cost of creating the housing is, the income target for the population they hope to serve, and then the agency provides that challenge fund resource to the developer to fill that gap. So I can't say specifically all of the costs it gets used for, but it is a broad variety of costs that go into getting a home buyer into a house in an affordable manner.
So then when it talks a line before about the dedicated money under this section must supplement traditional sources for funding, but must not be used as a substitute. I mean, are we currently doing this anyway?
Madam Chair and Representative McFarland, I think what that is saying is that the projection is that the MHFA will be allocated about $43 million a year. And about $9 million currently goes out to the Challenge Fund. And someone correct me if I'm wrong on this. What I believe this says is that these additional dollars that are now coming in, starting with in 2012, be $19 million new, and could not supplant the $9 million already there, is my understanding of that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mr. Hallbeck.
And that's absolutely correct. Now, if I could just add a word of some of the philosophy behind this is, as was mentioned, there's a 33,000 units that were identified that needed affordable housing units needed in the state. And as Representative Severson was saying, that number can really change. It probably will go up some. But the idea when that number was identified, that was back in 2003, it was saying that there is a level of public and charitable resources that are now going in every year to create affordable housing. And however, that level is insufficient to get at that projected additional need of 33,000. And so the idea here is that we need a continuation of the resources the state has been investing in housing to do the sorts of things it has been. But if we're going to get at that accumulated additional increment backlog of needed affordable housing in the state, we have to do something differently. We need a new resource. And this doesn't do it all, but it is a way of providing a new resource to get at something the state, through the regular budgeting process, hasn't, and with existing federal resources, has not been able to get at.
Did you have your question answered, Representative McFarland?
No.
Okay. Representative Saylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my question would probably be primarily for Representative Marquardt, but possibly for Mr. Hallbeck. And this has to do with Representative Marquardt talked about all of the reasons why it is so imperative that we increase housing, one of which was transportation. I know you mentioned Digi-Key, which is up in Thief River Falls, and I have spoken to some people in my district that are almost 2 hours away that work there because their housing is that far away. And I'm just wondering on the transportation issue, are there figures somewhere? Because I know it makes a very, very big impact in rural Minnesota when there isn't, you know, available housing near one of the larger businesses. So I just was curious if you had figures about transportation. Not that I think we need those to support it more, but I think it would be interesting to know what they are if you have those, because it's a very big issue. And I think furthermore on the transportation, the whole business, I mean, if we're looking for more reasons why it's important to do this, it's also, you know, saving on gasoline, you know, that while in areas that really do not have opportunities for public transportation to any significant degree.
Representative Markworth.
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Saylor, you're exactly right. I mean, if someone, I don't have those statistics, by the way, and I do know on the average people in rural Minnesota travel more miles. I've seen those stats, but I don't know how it relates to their going to and from their job. But as you mentioned, 2 hours on the road a day, you know, or just one way, or 30 miles one way, you're spending at least 2 or 3 gallons of gas, which is $9. I mean, that's at least an hour's worth of work. So you're losing that as you have to go from place to place, besides the employer having a less stable workforce in getting people to and from and so forth. But it's a big part of it, especially in rural Minnesota, as we look at workforce development and employers in rural Minnesota trying to attract employees.
Representative Saylor? I'm not mistaken. I know one of the original impetuses for creating the challenge grant was to talk about workforce housing and the fact that we wanted local units of government, but also employers and companies who needed their workers to have housing more closer to them to invest. And there is a requirement that there be some additional funding from those sources still. So hopefully that is going to be stimulated even more. Any further comments or questions? If not, it looks like House File 3725 is before us. No further discussion. All those in favor? And it's going to be moved to the Committee on Finance.
Madam Chair.
Representative Markworth.
I just have one.
Oh, of course. I'm sorry.
I first of all want to thank you and the committee for having this discussion today. And I want to thank all the testifiers, not only for their great testimony, but for all the help, too, on everything. I appreciate that. But Representative Severson brought up a great point. You know, we have a lot of competition for dollars here. And as we move into the future, it's going to get even tighter. And so I'm thinking, if we had $1 sitting right here to be spent, you know, where would we spend that dollar? And I think we would want to spend that dollar where we knew we could get some leverage and we could also address goals that we all agree on. And with affordable housing, we all agree with the goals and the concerns that would address homelessness and family stability and job creation and economic development out in rural Minnesota, all of these things. And so as we talk about that, I think that's very important when we look at the issue of affordable housing, especially when you get $1 leveraged to another 6 to 9, as the testimony said. I think it would rank as one of our very top priorities. But again, thank you for hearing this, and I just appreciate everyone who's involved with this effort. Thank you.
Thank you for your leadership. Okay, House File 3725. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Looks like you have unanimous movement to the next committee.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much.
Thank you. I guess we have the minutes from our last meeting, which is April 14th. Representative Saylor, did you get a chance to look at those minutes? Okay. Representative Saylor, would like to move the minutes. Approval of the minutes from April 14th. Any discussion? Not. All those in favor signify by saying aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved and adopted. And unless there's any other business to come before the committee, we are adjourned.